Side 8, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 268. He felt love for everything around him, and most of all for his dad, who would grin over at him and holler, "Hold on, Mikey, we gon' wind this baby up. We gon' make some birds run for cover." Then he would tear up the driveway, the A's rear wheels spitting back black dirt and gray clods of clay, both of them jouncing up and down on the sofa seat inside the open cab, laughing like stark natural-born fools. Will would run the A through the high grass of the back field, which was kept for hay, toward either the south field, potatoes, the west field, corn and beans, or the east field, peas, squash, and pumpkins. As they went, birds would burst up out of the grass before the truck, squawking in terror. Once a partridge flew up, a magnificent bird as brown as late autumn oaks, the explosive coughing whir of its wings audible even over the pounding engine. Those rides were Mike Hanlon's door into spring. The year's work began with the rock harvest. Every day for a week they would take the A out and load the bed with rocks which might break a harrow blade when the time came to turn the earth and plant. Sometimes the truck would get stuck in the mucky spring earth, and Will would mutter darkly under his breath. More swears, Mike surmised. He knew some of the words and expressions. Others, such as son of a whore, puzzled him. He had come across the word in the Bible, and so far as he could tell, a whore was a woman who came from a place called Babylon. He had once set out to ask his father, but the A had been in mud up to her coil springs, there had been thunderclouds on his father's brow, and he had decided to wait for a better time. He ended up asking Richie Tozier later that year, and Richie told him his father had told him a whore was a woman who got paid for having sex with men. "What's having sex?" Mike had asked, and Richie had wandered away holding his head. On one occasion, Mike had asked his father why, since they harvested rocks every April, there were always more of them the following April. They had been standing at the dumping-off place near sunset on the last day of that year's rock harvest. A beaten dirt track, not quite serious enough to be called a road, led from the bottom of the west field to this gully near the bank of the Kanduskeag. The gully was a jumbled wasteland of rocks that had been dragged off Will's land through the years. Looking down at this badlands, which he had made first alone and then with the help of his son, somewhere under the rocks he knew were the rotting remains of the stumps he had yanked out one at a time before any of the fields could be tilled. Will had lighted a cigarette and said, "My daddy used to tell me that God loved rocks, house flies, weeds, and poor people above all the rest of his creations, and that's why he made so many of them."
"But every year it's like they come back."
"Yeah, I think they do," Will said. "That's the only way I know to explain it." A loon cried from the far side of the Kanduskeag in a dusky sunset that had turned the water a deep orange-red. It was a lonely sound, so lonely that it made Mike's tired arms tighten with goose flesh.
"I love you, Daddy," he said suddenly,
feeling his love so strongly that tears stung his eyes. "Why, I love you too, Mikey," his father said, and hugged him tight in his strong arms. Mike felt the rough fabric of his father's flannel shirt against his cheek. "Now what do you say we go on back? We got just time to get a bath each before the good woman puts supper on the table."
"Yeah," Mike said.
"Yeah, yourself," Will Hanlon said, and they both laughed, feeling tired but feeling good, arms and legs worked but not overworked, their hands rock-roughened but not hurting too bad. "Spring's here," Mike thought that night, drowsing off in his room while his mother and father watched the honeymooners in the other room. "Spring's here again. Thank you, God. Thank you very much." And turning to sleep, sinking down, he had heard the loon call again, the distance of its marshes blending into the desire of his dreams. Spring was a busy time, but it was a good time. Following the rock harvest, Will would park the A in the high grass back of the house and drive the tractor out of the barn. There would be harrowing then, his father driving the tractor, Mike either riding behind and holding on to the iron seat, or walking alongside, picking up any rocks they had missed and throwing them aside. Then came planting, and following the planting came summer's work, hoeing, hoeing,
hoeing. His mother would refurbish Larry, Moe, and Curly, their three scarecrows, and Mike would help his father put moose blowers on top of each straw-filled head. A moose blower was a can with both ends cut off. You tied a length of heavily waxed and rosin string tightly across the middle of the can, and when the wind blew through it, a wonderfully spooky sound resulted, a kind of whining croak. Crop-eating birds decided soon enough that Larry, Moe, and Curly were no threats, but the moose blowers always frightened them off. Starting in July, there was picking as well as hoeing, peas and radishes first, then the lettuce and the tomatoes that had been started in the shed boxes, then the corn and beans in August, more corn and beans in September, then the pumpkins and the squash. Somewhere in the midst of all that came the new potatoes. And then, as the days shortened and the air sharpened, he and his dad would take in the moose blowers, and sometime during the winter they would disappear. It seemed they had to make new ones each spring. The day after, Will would call Norman Sadler, who was as dumb as his son Moose, but infinitely more good-hearted, and Normie would come over with his potato digger. For the next 3 weeks, all of them would work picking potatoes. In addition to the family, Will would hire three or four high school boys to help pick, paying them a quarter a barrel. The A Ford would cruise slowly up and down the rows of the south field, the biggest field, always in low gear, the tailgate down, the back filled with barrels, each marked with the name of the person picking into it. And at the end of the day, Will would open his old creased wallet and pay each of the pickers cash money. Mike was paid, and so was his mother. That money was theirs, and Will Hanlon never once asked either of them what they did with it. Mike had been given a 5% interest in the farm when he was 5 years old. Old enough, Will had told him then, to hold a hoe and to tell the difference between which grass and pea plants. Each year he had been given another 1%, and each year, on the day after Thanksgiving, Will would compute the farm's profits and deduct Mike's share. But Mike never saw any of that money. It went into his college account and was to be touched under absolutely no other circumstances. At last the day would come when Normie Sadler drove his potato digger back home. By then the air would have most likely turned gray and cold, and there would be frost on the drift of orange pumpkins piled against the side of the barn. Mike would stand in the dooryard, his nose red, his dirty hands stuffed into his jeans pockets, and watch as his father drove first the tractor and then the A Ford back into the barn. He would think, "We're getting ready to go to sleep again. Spring, vanished. Summer, gone. Harvest time, done." All that was left now was the butt end of autumn. Leafless trees, frozen ground, a lacing of ice along the banks of the Kenduskeag. In the fields, crows would sometimes land on the shoulders of Moe, Larry, and Curly, and stay as long as they liked. The scarecrows were voiceless, threatless. Mike would not exactly be dismayed by the thought of another year ending. At 9 and 10, he was still too young to make mortal metaphors. Because there was plenty to look forward to. Sledding in McCarran Park, or on Rulin Hill out here in Derrytown if you were brave, although that was mostly for big kids. Ice skating, snowball fights, snow fort building. There was time to think about snowshoeing out for a Christmas tree with his daddy, and time to think about the Nordica downhill skis he might or might not get for Christmas. Winter was good, but watching his father drive the A back into the barn. Spring vanished, summer gone, harvest time done. Always made him feel sad. The way the squadrons of birds heading south for the winter made him feel sad, or the way a certain slant of light could sometimes make him feel like crying for no good reason. We're getting ready to go to sleep again. It was not all school and chores, chores and school. Will Hanlon had told his wife more than once that a boy needed time to go fishing, even if it wasn't fishing he was really doing. When Mike came home from school, he first put his books on the TV in the parlor, second made himself some kind of snack. He was particularly partial to peanut butter and onion sandwiches, a taste that made his mother raise her hands in helpless horror, and third studied the note his father had left him, telling Mike where he, Will, was and what Mike's chores were. Certain rows to be weeded or picked, baskets to be carried, produce to be rotated, the barn to be swept, whatever. But on at least one school day a week, and sometimes two, there would be no note. And on these days, Mike would go fishing, even if it wasn't really fishing he was doing. Those were great days, days when he had no particular place to go and consequently felt no urge to get there in a hurry. Once in a while, his father left him another sort of note. No chores, one might say. Go over to Old Cape and look at trolley tracks. Mike would go over to the Old Cape area, find the streets with the tracks still embedded in them, and inspect them closely, marveling to think of things like trains that had run right through the middle of the streets. That night, he and his father might talk about them, and his dad would show him pictures from his dairy album of the trolleys actually running. A funny pole went from the roof of the trolley up to an electrical wire, and there were cigarette ads on the side. Another time he had sent Mike to Memorial Park, where the standpipe was, to look at the bird bath. And once they had gone to the courthouse together to look at a terrible machine that Chief Borton had found in the attic. This gadget was called a tramp chair. It was cast iron, and there were manacles built into the arms and legs. Rounded knobs stuck out of the back and seat. It reminded Mike of a photograph he had seen in some book, a photograph of the electric chair at Sing Sing. Chief Borton let Mike sit in the tramp chair and try on the manacles. After the first ominous novelty of wearing the manacles wore off, Mike looked questioningly at his father and Chief Borton, not sure why this was supposed to be such a horrible punishment for the vagues, Borton's word for them, that had drifted into town in the 20s and 30s. The knobs made the chair a little uncomfortable to sit in, sure, and the manacles on your wrists and ankles made it hard to shift to a more comfortable position, but...
Well, you're just a kid, Chief Borton said, laughing. What do you weigh? 70, 80 pounds? Most of the vague Sheriff Sully posted into that chair in the old days would go twice that. They'd feel a bit uncomfortable after an hour or so, really uncomfortable after two or three, and right bad after four or five. After 7 or 8 hours, they'd start bellerin', and after 16 or 17, they'd start crying, mostly. And by the time their 24-hour tour was up, they'd be willing to swear before God and man that the next time they came riding the rods up New England way, they'd give Derry a wide berth. So far as I know, most of them did. 24 hours in the tramp chair was a hell of a persuader.
Suddenly there seemed to be more knobs in the chair, digging more deeply into his buttocks, spine, the small of his back, even the nape of his neck. "Can I get out now, please?" he said politely, and Chief Borton laughed again. There was a moment, one panicked instant of time, when Mike thought the chief would only dangle the key to the manacles in front of Mike's eyes and say,
"Sure, I'll let you out, when your 24 hours is up." "Why did you take me there, Daddy?" he asked on the way home. "You'll know when you're older," Will had replied. "You don't like Chief Borton, do you?"
"No," his father had replied in a voice so curt that Mike hadn't dared ask any more. But Mike enjoyed most of the places in Derry his father sent or took him to, and by the time Mike was 10, Will had succeeded in conveying his own interest in the layers of Derry's history to his son. Sometimes, as when he had been trailing his fingers over the slightly pebbled surface of the stand in which the Memorial Park bird bath was set, or when he had squatted down to look more closely at the trolley tracks which grooved Mott Street in the Old Cape, he would be struck by a profound sense of time. Time as something real, as something that had unseen weight, the way sunlight was supposed to have weight. Some of the kids in school had laughed when Mrs. Greengus told them that, but Mike had been too stunned by the concept to laugh. His first thought had been, "Light has weight? Oh, my Lord, that's terrible." Time as something that would eventually bury him. The first note his father left him in that spring of 1958 was scribbled on the back of an envelope and held down with a salt shaker. The air was spring warm, wonderfully sweet, and his mother had opened all the windows. "No chores," the note read. "If you want to, ride your bike out to Pasture Road. You'll see a lot of tumbled masonry and old machinery out in the field on your left. Have a look around. Bring back a souvenir. Don't go near the cellar hole. And be back before dark. You know why." Mike knew why, all right. He told his mother where he was going, and she frowned.
"Why don't you see if Randy Robinson wants to go with you?"
"Yeah, okay. I'll stop by and ask him," Mike said. He did, too, but Randy had gone up to Bangor with his father to buy seedling potatoes. So Mike rode his bike over to Pasture Road alone. It was a goodish ride, a little over 4 miles. Mike reckoned it was 3 o'clock by the time he leaned his bike against an old wooden slat fence on the left side of Pasture Road and climbed into the field beyond. He would have maybe an hour to explore, and then he would have to start home again. Ordinarily, his mother would not be upset with him as long as he was back by 6, when she put dinner on the table. But one memorable episode had taught him that wasn't the case this year. On that one occasion when he had been late for dinner, she had been nearly hysterical. She took after him with a dish rag, whopping him with it as he stood open-mouthed in the kitchen entryway, his wicker creel with the rainbow trout in it at his feet. "Don't you ever scare me like that," she had screamed. Don't you ever, 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 ever." Each ever had been punctuated by another dish rag swat. Mike had expected his father to step in and put a stop to it, but his father hadn't done so. Perhaps he knew that if he did, she would turn her wildcat anger on him as well. Mike had learned the lesson. One whopping with the dish rag was all it took. Home before dark. Yes, ma'am. Righto. He walked across the field toward the Titanic ruin standing in the center. This was, of course, the remains of the Kitchener Ironworks. He had ridden past it, but had never thought to actually explore it. And he had never heard any kid saying that they had. Now, stooping to examine a few tumbled bricks that had formed a rough cairn, he thought he could understand why. The field was dazzlingly bright, washed by sun from the spring sky. Occasionally, as a cloud passed before the sun, a great shudder of shadow would travel slowly across the field. But there was something spooky about it all the same, a brooding silence that was broken only by the wind. He felt like an explorer who has found the last remnants of some fabulous lost city. Up ahead and to the right, he saw the rounded side of a massive tile cylinder rising out of the high field grass. He ran over to it. It was the ironworks' main smokestack. He peered into its bore and felt a fresh chill worm up his spine. It was big enough so he could have walked into it if he had wanted. But he didn't want to. God knew what strange guck there might be, clinging to the smoke-blackened inner tiles, or what nasty bugs or beasts might have taken up residence inside. The wind gusted. When it blew across the mouth of the fallen stack, it made a sound eerily like the sound of the wind vibrating the waxed strings he and his dad put in the moose blowers every spring. He stepped back nervously, suddenly thinking about the movie he and his father had watched last night on the early show. It had been called Rodin, and watching it had seemed like great fun at the time, his father laughing and shouting, "Get that bird, Mikey!" every time Rodin made its appearance. Mike shooting with his finger until his mom popped her head in and told them to hush up before they gave her a headache with the noise. It didn't seem so funny now. In the movie, Rodin had been released from the bowels of the earth by these Japanese coal miners who had been digging the world's deepest tunnel. And looking into the black bore of this pipe, it was all too easy to imagine that bird crouched at the far end, leathery bat-like wings folded over its back, staring at the small round boy face looking into the darkness, staring, staring with its gold-ringed eyes. Shivering, Mike pulled back. He walked a ways down the smokestack, which had sunken into the earth to half of its circumference. The land rose slightly, and on impulse he scrambled his way up on top. The stack was a lot less scary on the outside, its tiled surface sun warm. He got to his feet and strolled along, holding his arms out. The surface was really too wide for him to need to worry about falling off, but he was pretending he was a tight wire walker in the circus, liking the way the wind blew through his hair. At the far end he jumped down and began to examine stuff. More bricks, twisted molds, hunks of wood, pieces of rusty machinery. "Bring back a souvenir," his father's note had said. He wanted a good one. He wandered closer to the mill's yawning cellar hold, looking at the debris, being careful not to cut himself on the broken glass. There was a lot of it around. Mike was not unmindful of the cellar hold and his father's warning to stay out of it. Neither was he unmindful of the death that had been dealt out on this spot 50-odd years before. He supposed that if there was a haunted place in Derry, this was it. But either in spite of that or because of it, he was determined to stay until he found something really good to take back and show his father.
He moved slowly and soberly toward the cellar hold, changing his course to parallel its ragged side, when a warning voice inside whispered that he was getting too close, that a bank weakened by the spring rains could crumble under his heels and pitch him into that hole, where God only knew how much sharp iron might be waiting to impale him like a bug, leaving him to die a rusty, twitching death. He picked up a window sash and tossed it aside. Here was a dipper big enough for a giant's table, its handle rippled and warped by some unimaginable flash of heat. Here was a piston too big for him to even budge, let alone lift. He stepped over it. He stepped over it and... What if I find a skull? He thought suddenly. The skull of one of the kids who were killed here while they were hunting for chocolate Easter eggs back in 19-whatever it was. He looked around the sun-washed, empty field, nastily shocked by the idea. The wind blew a low conch note in his ears, and another shadow cruised silently across the field, like the shadow of a giant bat or bird. He became aware all over again of how quiet it was here, and how strange the field looked with its straggling piles of masonry and its beached iron hulks leaning this way and that. It was as if some horrid battle had been fought here long ago.
"Don't be such a dip," he replied uneasily to himself. "They found everything there was to find 50 years ago, after it happened. And even if they didn't, some other kid, or grown-up, would have found the rest, since then. Or do you think you're the only person who ever came here hunting for souvenirs?" No, I don't think that, but..." "But what?"
that rational side of his mind demanded. And Mike thought it was talking just a little too loud, a little too fast.
"Even if there was still something to find, it would have decayed long ago. So, what?"
Mike found a splintered desk drawer in the weeds. He glanced at it, tossed it aside, and moved a little closer to the cellar hold, where the stuff was thickest. Surely he would find something there.
"But what if there are ghosts?"
"That's but what. What if I see hands coming over the edge of that cellar hold, and what if they start to come up, kids in the remains of their Easter Sunday clothes? Clothes that are all rotted and torn and marked with 50 years of spring mud and fall rain and caked winter snow. Kids with no heads." He had heard at school that, after the explosion, a woman had found the head of one of the victims in a tree in her backyard.
"Kids with no legs. Kids flayed open like codfish. Kids just like me who would maybe come down and play. Down there where it's dark, under the leaning iron girders and the big old rusty cogs. Oh, stop it, for the Lord's sake."
But a shudder wrenched its way up his back, and he decided it was time to take something, anything, and get the dickens out of here. He reached down, almost at random, and came up with a gear-toothed wheel about 7 inches in diameter. He had a pencil in his pocket, and he used it quickly to dig the dirt out of the teeth. Then he slipped his souvenir in his pocket. He would go now. He would go, yes. But his feet moved slowly in the wrong direction, toward the cellar hold. And he realized with a dismal sort of horror that he needed to look down inside. He had to see. He gripped a spongy support beam leaning out of the earth and swayed forward, trying to see down and inside. He couldn't quite do it. He had come to within 15 feet of the edge, but that was still a little too far to see the bottom of the cellar hold.
"I don't care if I see the bottom or not. I'm going back now. I've got my souvenir. I don't need to look down into any crummy old hole. And Daddy's note said to stay away from it."
But the unhappy, almost feverish curiosity that had gripped him would not let go. He approached the cellar hold step by queasy step, aware that as soon as the wooden beam was out of his reach, there would be no more grab holes. Also aware that the ground here was indeed squelchy and crumbly. In places along the edge he could see depressions, like graves that had fallen in, and knew that they were the sites of previous cave-ins. Heart thudding in his chest like the hard-measured strides of a soldier's boots, he reached the edge and looked down. Nested in the cellar hold, the bird looked up. Mike was not at first sure what he was seeing. All the nerves and pathways in his body seemed frozen, including those which conducted thoughts. It was not just the shock of seeing a monster bird, a bird whose breast was as orange as a robin's and whose feathers were the unremarkable fluffy gray of a sparrow's feathers. Most of it was the shock of the utterly unexpected. He had expected monoliths of machinery half-submerged in stagnant puddles and black mud. Instead, he was looking down into a giant nest which filled the cellar hold from end to end and side to side. It had been made out of enough timothy grass to make a dozen bales of hay, but this grass was silvery and old. The bird sat in the middle of it, its brightly ringed eyes as black as fresh warm tar, and for an insane moment before his paralysis broke, Mike could see himself reflected in each of them. Then the ground suddenly began to shift and run out from beneath his feet. He heard the tearing sound of shallow roots giving way and realized he was sliding. With a yell, he threw himself backward, pinwheeling his arms for balance. He lost it and thumped heavily to the littered ground. Some hard, dull chunk of metal pressed painfully into his back, and he had time to think of the tramp chair before he heard the whirring, explosive sound of the bird's wings. He scrambled to his knees, crawled, looked back over his shoulder, and saw it rising out of the cellar hold. Its scaly talons were a dusky orange. Its beating wings, each more than 10 feet across, blew the scraggy timothy grass this way and that, patternlessly, like the wind generated by helicopter rotors. It uttered a buzzing, chirruping scream. A few loose feathers slipped from its wings and spiraled back down into the cellar hold. Mike gained his feet again and began to run. He pounded across the field, not looking back now, afraid to look back. The bird did not look like Rodan, but he sensed it was the spirit of Rodan, risen from the cellar hold of the Kitchener Ironworks like a horrible bird in the box. He stumbled, went to one knee, got up, and ran on. That weird, chirruping, buzzing screech came again. A shadow covered him, and when he looked up, he saw the thing. It had passed less than 5 feet over his head. Its beak, dirty yellow, opened and closed, revealing a pink lining inside. It whirled back toward Mike. The wind it generated washed across his face, bringing a dry, unpleasant smell with it. Attic dust, dead antiques, rotting cushions. He jigged to his left, and now he saw the fallen smokestack again. He sprinted for it, running all out, his arms pumping in short, jabbing strokes at his sides. The bird screamed, and he heard its fluttering wings. They sounded like sails. Something slammed into the back of his head. Warm fire traced its way up the nape of his neck. He felt it spread as blood began to trickle down the back of his shirt collar. The bird whirled around again, meaning to pick him up with its talons and carry him away like a hawk with a field mouse, meaning to carry him back to its nest, meaning to eat him. As it flew at him, swooping down, its black, horribly alive eyes fixed on him, Mike cut sharply right. The bird missed him, barely. The dusty smell of its wings was overpowering, unbearable. Now he was running parallel to the fallen smokestack, its tiles blurring by. He could see where it ended. If he could reach the end and buttonhook to the left, get inside, he might be safe. He thought the bird was too big to squeeze inside. He came very close to not making it. The bird flew at him again, pulling up as it closed in, its wings flapping and pushing air in a hurricane, its scaly talons now angled toward him and descending. It screamed again, and this time Mike thought he heard triumph in its voice. He lowered his head, put his arm up, and rammed straight forward. The talons closed, and for a moment the bird had him by the forearm. The grip was like the clutch of incredibly strong fingers tipped with tough nails. They bit like teeth. The bird's flapping wings were a thunder in his ears. He was dimly aware of feathers falling around him, some brushing past his cheeks like phantom kisses. The bird rose then, and for just a moment Mike felt himself pulled upward, first straight, then on tiptoe. And for one freezing second he felt the toes of his kids lose contact with the earth. "Let me go!" he screamed at it, and twisted his arm. For a moment the talons held on, and then the sleeve of his shirt ripped. He thumped back down. The bird squalled. Mike ran again, brushing through the thing's tail feathers, gagging at that dry smell. It was like running through a shower curtain of feathers. Still coughing, eyes stinging from both tears and whatever vile dust coated the bird's feathers, he stumbled into the fallen smokestack. There was no thought now of what might be lurking inside. He ran into the darkness, his gasping sobs taking on a flat echo. He went back perhaps 20 feet and then turned toward the bright circle of daylight. His chest was rising and falling in quick jerks. He was suddenly aware that, if he had misjudged either the size of the bird or the size of the smokestack's muzzle. He had killed himself as surely as if he had put his father's shotgun to his head and pulled the trigger. There was no way out. This wasn't just a pipe, it was a blind alley. The other end of the stack was buried in the earth. The bird squalled again, and suddenly the light at the end of the smokestack was blotted out as it lighted on the ground outside. He could see its yellow scaly legs, each as thick as a man's calf. Then it cocked its head down and looked inside. Mike found himself again staring into those hideously bright, fresh tar eyes with their gold wedding rings of iris. The bird's beak opened and closed, and each time it snapped shut, he heard an audible click, like the sound you hear in your own ears when you snap your teeth together hard. Sharp, he thought. Its beak is sharp. I guess I knew birds had sharp beaks, but I never really thought about it until now. It squawked again. The sound was so loud in the tiled throat of the stack that Mike clapped his hands to his ears. The bird began to force itself into the mouth of the stack. No, Mike cried. No, you can't. The light faded as more of the bird's body pressed its way into the stack's bore. Oh, my Lord, why didn't I remember it was mostly feathers? Why didn't I remember it could squeeze? The light faded, was gone. Now there was only an inky blackness, the suffocating attic smell of the bird, and the rustling sound of its feathers. Mike fell on his knees and began to grope on the curved floor of the smokestack, his hands spread wide, feeling. He found a piece of broken tile, its sharp edges furred with what felt like moss. He cocked his arm back and pegged it. There was a thump. The bird uttered its buzzing, chirruping sound again. "Get out of here!" Mike screamed. There was silence. And then that crackly, rustling sound began again as the bird resumed forcing itself into the pipe. Mike felt along the floor, found other pieces of tile, and began to throw one after another. They thumped and thudded off the bird, and then clinked to the tile sleeve of the smokestack. "Please, God," Mike thought incoherently. "Please, God, please, God, please, God." It came to him that he ought to retreat down the smokestack's bore. He had run in through what had been the stack's base. It stood to reason that it would narrow as he backed up. He could retreat, yes, and listen to that low, dusty rustle as the bird worked its way in after him. He could retreat, and if he was lucky, he might get beyond the point where the bird could continue to advance. But what if the bird got stuck? If that happened, he and the bird would die in here together. They would die in here together and rot in here together, in the dark. "Please, God!" he screamed, and was totally unaware that he had cried out loud. He threw another piece of tile, and this time his throw was more powerful. He felt, he told the others much later, as if someone were behind him at that moment, and that someone had given his arm a tremendous push. This time there was no feathery thud. Instead, there was a splatting sound, the sound a kid's hand might make slapping into the surface of a bowl of half-solidified jello. This time the bird screamed, not in anger, but in real pain. The tenebrous whir of its wings filled the smokestack. Stinking air streamed past Mike in a hurricane, flapping his clothes, making him cough and gag and retreat as dust and moss flew. Light appeared again, gray and weak at first, then brightening and shifting as the bird retreated from the stack's muzzle. Mike burst into tears, fell to his knees again, and began grubbing madly for more pieces of tile. Without any conscious thought, he ran forward with both hands full of tiling. In this light, he could see the pieces were splotched with blue-gray moss and lichen, like the surface of slate gravestones, until he was nearly at the mouth of the stack. He intended to keep the bird from coming back in if he could. It bent down, cocking its head the way a trained bird on a perch will sometimes cock its head, and Mike saw where his last shot had struck home. The bird's right eye was nearly gone. Instead of that glittering bubble of fresh tar, there was a crater filled with blood. Whitish-gray goo dripped from the corner of the socket and trickled along the side of the bird's beak. Tiny parasites wriggled and squirmed in this pussy discharge. It saw him and lunged forward. Mike began to throw chunks of tile at it. They struck its head and beak. It withdrew for a moment and then lunged again, beak opening, revealing that pink lining again, revealing something else that caused Mike to freeze for a moment, his own mouth dropping open.
The bird's tongue was silver, its surface as crazy cracked as the surface of a volcanic land which has first baked and then slagged off. And on this tongue, like weird tumbleweeds that had taken temporary root there, were a number of orange puffs. Mike threw the last of his tiles directly into that gaping maw, and the bird withdrew again, screaming its frustration, rage, and pain. For a moment, Mike could see its reptilian talons. Then its wings ruffled the air, and it was gone. A moment later, he lifted his face, a face that was gray-brown under the dirt, dust, and bits of moss that the bird's wind machine wings had blown at him, toward the clicking sound of its talons on the tile. The only clean places on Mike's face were the tracks that had been washed clean by his tears. The bird walked back and forth overhead. Tack, 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 tack. Mike retreated a bit, gathered up more chunks of tile, and heaped them as close to the mouth of the stack as he dared. If the thing came back, he wanted to be able to fire at it from point-blank range. The light outside was still bright. Now that it was May, it wouldn't get dark for a long time yet. But suppose the bird just decided to wait? Mike swallowed, the dry sides of his throat rubbing together for a moment. Overhead, tack, tack, tack. He had a fine pile of ammunition now. In the dim light, here beyond the place where the angle of the sun made a shadow spiral inside the pipe, it looked like a pile of broken crockery swept together by a housewife. Mike rubbed the palms of his dirty hands along the sides of his jeans and waited to see what would happen next. A space of time passed before something did, whether 5 minutes or 25, he could not tell. He was only aware of the bird walking back and forth overhead, like an insomniac pacing the floor at 3 in the morning. Then its wings fluttered again. It landed in front of the smokestack's opening. Mike, on his knees just behind his pile of tiling, began to peg missiles at it before it could even bend its head down. One of them slammed into a plated yellow leg and drew a trickle of blood so dark it seemed almost as black as the bird's eyes. Mike screamed in triumph, the sound thin and almost lost under the bird's own enraged squawk.
"Get out of here!"
Mike cried. "I'm going to keep hitting you until you get out of here. I swear to God I will." The bird flew up to the top of the smokestack and resumed its pacing. Mike waited. Finally, its wings ruffled again as it took off. Mike waited, expecting the yellow feet, so like hen's feet, to appear again. They didn't. He waited longer, convinced it had to be some kind of trick, realizing at last that that wasn't why he was waiting at all. He was waiting because he was scared to go out, scared to leave the safety of this bolt hole.
"Never mind. Never mind stuff like that. I'm not a rabbit."
He took as many chunks of tile as he could handle comfortably, then put some more inside his shirt. He stepped out of the smokestack, trying to look everywhere at once and wishing madly for eyes in the back of his head. He saw only the field stretching ahead and around him, littered with the exploded, rusting remains of the Kitchener ironworks. He wheeled around, sure he would see the bird perched on the lip of the stack like a vulture, a one-eyed vulture now, only wanting the boy to see him before it attacked for the final time, using that sharp beak to jab and rip and strip. But the bird was not there. It was really gone. Mike's nerves snapped. He uttered a breaking scream of fear and ran for the weather-beaten fence between the field and the road, dropping the last pieces of tile from his hands. Most of the others fell out of his shirt as the shirt pulled free of his belt. He vaulted over the fence one-handed, like Roy Rogers showing off for Dale Evans on his way back from the corral with Pat Brady and the rest of the buckaroos. He grabbed the handlebars of his bike and ran beside it 40 feet up the road before getting on. Then he pedaled madly, not daring to look back, not daring to slow down, until he reached the intersection of Pasture Road and Outer Main Street, where there were lots of cars passing back and forth. When he got home, his father was changing the plugs on the tractor. Will observed that Mike looked powerful, musty, and dusty. Mike hesitated for just a split second and then told his father that he'd taken a tumble from his bike on the way home, swerving to avoid a pothole.
"Did you break anything, Mikey?"
Will asked, observing his son a little more carefully.
"No, sir."
"Sprains?"
"Uh-uh."
"Sure."
Mike nodded.
"Did you pick yourself up a souvenir?"
Mike reached into his pocket and found the gear wheel. He showed it to his father, who looked at it briefly and then plucked a tiny crumb of tiling from the pad of flesh just below Mike's thumb. He seemed more interested in this.
"From that old smokestack?" Will asked.
Mike nodded.
"You go inside there?"
Mike nodded again.
"See anything in there?" Will asked,
and then, as if to make a joke of the question, which hadn't sounded like a joke at all, he added,
"Buried treasure?"
Smiling a little, Mike shook his head.
"Well, don't tell your mother you was mucking about in there," Will said. "She'd shoot me first and you second."
He looked even more closely at his son.
"Mikey, are you all right?"
"Huh?"
"You look a little peaky around the eyes."
"I guess I might be a little tired," Mike said. "It's 8 or 10 miles there and back again, don't forget. You want some help with the tractor, Daddy?"
"Nope, I'm about done screwing it up for this week. You go on in and wash up."
Mike started away, and then his father called to him once more. Mike looked back.
"I don't want you going around that place again," he said. "At least not until all this trouble is cleared up and they catch the man who's doing it. You didn't see anybody out there, did you? No one chased you or hollered you down?"
"I didn't see any people at all," Mike said.
Will nodded and lit a cigarette.
"I think I was wrong to send you there. Old places like that, sometimes they can be dangerous."
Their eyes locked briefly.
"Okay, Daddy," Mike said. "I don't want to go back anyway. It was a little spooky."
Will nodded again.
"Less said the better, I reckon. You go and get cleaned up now. And tell her to put on 3 or 4 extra sausages."
Mike did. 6.
"Never mind that now," Mike Hanlon thought, looking at the grooves which went up to the concrete edge of the canal and stopped there. "Never mind that. It might just have been a dream anyhow, and..."
There were splotches of dried blood on the lip of the canal. Mike looked at these, and then he looked down into the canal. Black water flowed smoothly past. Runners of dirty yellow foam clung to the canal's sides, sometimes breaking free to flow downstream in lazy loops and curves. For a moment, just a moment, two clots of this foam came together and seemed to form a face, a kid's face. Its eyes turned up in an avatar of terror and agony. Mike's breath caught, as if on a thorn. The foam broke apart, became meaningless again, and at that moment there was a loud splash on his right. Mike snapped his head around, shrinking back a little, and for a moment he believed he saw something in the shadows of the outflow tunnel where the canal resurfaced after its course under downtown. Then it was gone. Suddenly, cold and shuddering, he dug in his pocket for the knife he had found in the grass. He threw it into the canal. There was a small splash, a ripple that began as a circle and then was tugged into the shape of an arrowhead by the current. Then nothing. Nothing except the fear that was suddenly suffocating him and the deadly certainty that there was something near, something watching him, gauging its chances, biding its time. He turned, meaning to walk back to his bike. To run would be to dignify those fears and undignify himself. And then that splashing sound came again. It was a lot louder the second time. So much for dignity. Suddenly he was running as fast as he could, beating his buns for the gate and his bike, jamming the kickstand up with one heel and pedaling for the street as fast as he could. That sea smell was all at once too thick, much too thick. It was everywhere, and the water dripping from the wet branches of the trees seemed much too loud. Something was coming. He heard dragging, lurching footsteps in the grass. He stood on the pedals, giving it everything, and shot out onto Main Street without looking back. He headed for home as fast as he could, wondering what in hell had possessed him to come in the first place. What had drawn him? And then he tried to think about the chores, the whole chores, and nothing but the chores. After a while, he actually succeeded. And when he saw the headline in the paper the next day, "Missing Boy Prompts New Fears," he thought about the pocket knife he had thrown into the canal. The pocket knife with the initials EC scratched on the side. He thought about the blood he had seen on the grass. And he thought about those grooves which stopped at the edge of the canal. Chapter 7. The Dam in the Barrens. 1.
Seen from the expressway at 4:45 in the morning, Boston seems a city of the dead brooding over some tragedy in its past. A plague, perhaps, or a curse. The smell of salt, heavy and cloying, comes off the ocean. Runners of early morning fog obscure much of what movement would be seen otherwise. Driving north along Storrow Drive, sitting behind the wheel of the black 84 Cadillac he picked up from Butch Carrington at Cape Cod Limousine, Eddie Kasprak thinks you can feel this city's age. Perhaps you can get that feeling of age nowhere else in America but here. Boston is a sprat compared with London, an infant compared with Rome, but by American standards, at least, it is old, old. It kept its place on these low hills 300 years ago when the tea and stamp taxes were unthought of, Paul Revere and Patrick Henry unborn. Its age, its silence, and the foggy smell of the sea, all these things make Eddie nervous. When Eddie's nervous, he reaches for his aspirator. He sticks it in his mouth and triggers a cloud of revivifying spray down his throat. There are a few people in the streets he's passing, and a pedestrian or two on the walkways of the overpasses. They give lie to the impression that he has somehow wandered into a Lovecrafty tale of doomed cities, ancient evils, and monsters with unpronounceable names. Here, ganged around a bus stop with a sign reading, Kenmore Square, City Center, he sees waitresses, nurses, city employees, their faces naked and puffed with sleep. That's right, Eddie thinks, now passing under a sign which reads, Tobin Bridge. That's right. Stick to the buses. Forget the subways. The subways are a bad idea. I wouldn't go down there if I were you. Not down below, not in the tunnels. This is a bad thought to have. If he doesn't get rid of it, he will soon be using the aspirator again. He's glad for the heavier traffic on the Tobin Bridge. He passes a monument works. Painted on the brick side is a slightly unsettling admonishment. Slow down, we can wait. Here is a green reflectorized sign which reads, To 95, Maine, New Hampshire, all northern New England points. He looks at it and suddenly a bone-deep shudder racks his body. His hands momentarily weld themselves to the wheel of the Cadillac. He would like to believe it is the onset of some sickness, a virus or perhaps one of his mother's phantom fevers, but he knows better. It is the city behind him, poised silently on the straight edge that runs between day and night, and what that sign promises ahead of him. He's sick all right, no doubt about that, but it's not a virus or a phantom fever. He has been poisoned by his own memories. I'm scared, Eddie thinks. That was always what was at the bottom of it. Just being scared, that was everything. But in the end, I think we turned that around somehow. We used it. But how? He can't remember. He wonders if any of the others can. For all their sakes, he certainly hopes so. A truck drones by on his left. Eddie has still got his lights on, and now he hits his brights momentarily as the truck draws safely ahead. He does this without thinking. It has become an automatic function, just part of driving for a living. The unseen driver in the truck flashes his running lights in return, quickly twice, thanking Eddie for his courtesy. If only everything could be that simple and that clear, he thinks. He follows the signs to I-95. The northbound traffic is light, although he observes that the southbound lanes into the city are starting to fill up, even at this early hour. Eddie floats the big car along, pre-guessing most of the directional signs and getting into the correct lane long before he has to. It has been years, literally years, since he has guessed wrong enough to be swept past an exit he wanted. He makes his lane choices as automatically as he flashed OK to cut back in to the trucker, as automatically as he once found his way through the tangle of paths in the Dairy Barrens. The fact that he has never before in his life driven out of downtown Boston, one of the most confusing cities in America to drive in, does not seem to matter much at all. He suddenly remembers something else about that summer, something Bill said to him one day. You've got a humpus in your head, Eddie. How that had pleased him. It pleases him again as the 84 Dorado shoots back onto the turnpike. He slides the limo's speed up to a cop safe 57 miles an hour and finds some quiet music on the radio. He supposes he would have died for Bill back then, if that had been required. If Bill had asked him, Eddie would simply have responded, Sure, Big Bill. You got a time in mind yet?
Eddie laughs at this. Not much of a sound, just a snort, but the sound of it startles him into a real laugh. He laughs seldom these days, and he certainly did not expect to find many chucks, Richie's word meaning chuckles, as in, "You had any good chucks today, Eds?" on this black pilgrimage. But he supposes, if God is dirty mean enough to curse the faithful with what they want most in life, he's maybe quirky enough to deal you a good chuck or two along the way. "Had any good chucks lately, Eds?" he says out loud and laughs again. Man, he had hated it when Richie called him Eds. But he had sort of liked it, too. The way he thought Ben Hanscom got to like Richie calling him Haystack. It was something like a secret name. A secret identity. A way to be people that had nothing to do with their parents' fears, hopes, constant demands. Richie couldn't do his beloved voices for shit, but maybe he did know how important it was for creeps like them to sometimes be different people. Eddie glances at the change lined up neatly on the Dorado's dashboard. Lining up the change is another of those automatic tricks of the trade. When the toll booths come up, you never want to have to dig for your silver, never want to find that you've gotten in an automatic toll lane with the wrong change. Among the coins are two or three Susan B. Anthony silver dollars. They are coins, he reflects, that you probably only find in the pockets of chauffeurs and taxi drivers from the New York area these days. Just as the only place you are apt to see a lot of $2 bills is at a racetrack payoff window. He always keeps a few on hand because the robot toll-taker baskets on the George Washington and the Triborough bridges take them. Another of those lights suddenly comes on in his head. Silver dollars. Not these fake copper sandwiches, but real silver dollars, with Lady Liberty dressed in her gauzy robe stamped upon them. Ben Hanscom's silver dollars. Yes, but wasn't it Bill or Ben or Beverly who once used one of those silver cartwheels to save their lives? He is not quite sure of this, is, in fact, not quite sure of anything. Or is it just that he doesn't want to remember? It was dark in there, he thinks suddenly. I remember that much. It was dark in there. Boston is well behind him now, and the fog is starting to burn off. Ahead is Maine, New Hampshire, all northern New England points. Derry is ahead, and there is something in Derry which should be 27 years dead and yet is somehow not. Something with as many faces as Lon Chaney. But what is it really? Didn't they see it at the end as it really was, with all its masks cast aside? Ah, he can remember so much, but not enough. He remembers that he loved Bill Denbrough. He remembers that well enough. Bill never made fun of his asthma. Bill never called him little sissy queer boy. He loved Bill like he would have loved a big brother or a father. Bill knew stuff to do, places to go, things to see. Bill was never up against it. When you ran with Bill, you ran to beat the devil and you laughed, but you hardly ever ran out of breath. And hardly ever running out of breath was great, so fucking great, Eddie would tell the world. When you ran with Big Bill, you got your chucks every day. Sure, kid, every day, he says in a Richie Tozier voice and laughs again. It had been Bill's idea to make the dam in the Barrens, and it was, in a way, the dam that had brought them all together. Ben Hanscom had been the one to show them how the dam could be built, and they had built it so well that they'd gotten in a lot of trouble with Mr. Nell, the cop on the beat. But it had been Bill's idea, and although all of them except Richie had seen very odd things, frightening things, in Derry since the turn of the year, it had been Bill who had first found the courage to say something out loud. That dam. That damn dam. He remembered Victor Chris. Ta-ta, boys. It was a real baby dam, believe me. You're better off without it. A day later, Ben Hanscom was grinning at them, saying, "We could. We could flood. We could flood out the... two. Whole barrens if we wanted to." Bill and Eddie looked at Ben doubtfully, and then at the stuff Ben had brought along with him. Some boards, scrounged from Mr. McKibben's backyard, but that was okay, since Mr. McKibben had probably scavenged them from someone else's. A sledgehammer, a shovel. "I don't know," Eddie said, glancing at Bill. "When we tried yesterday, it didn't work very good. The current kept washing our sticks away." "This'll work," Ben said. He also looked to Bill for the final decision. Well, let's give it a try, Bill said. I could call Richie Tozier this morning. He's going to be over later, he said. Maybe him and Hanley will want to help.
Stanley who?
Ben asked. Urus, Eddie said. He was still looking cautiously at Bill, who seemed somehow different today. Quieter, less enthusiastic about the idea of the dam. Bill looked pale today, distant.
Stanley Urus. I guess I don't know him. Does he go to Derry Elementary?
He's our age, but he just finished the fourth grade, Eddie said. He started school a year late because he was sick a lot when he was a little kid. You think you took Chong yesterday? You just ought to be glad you're not Stan. Someone's always racking Stan to the dogs and back.
He's Jewish, Bill said. Lots of kids don't like him because he's Jewish.
Oh, yeah? Ben asked, impressed. Jewish, huh? He paused and then said carefully, Is that like being Turkish? Or is it more like, you know, Egyptian?
I could guess it's more like Turkish, Bill said.
He picked up one of the boards Ben had brought and looked at it. It was about 6 feet long and 3 feet wide.
My dad says most Jews have big noses and lots of money, but
But Stan's got a regular nose and he's always broke, Eddie said.
Yeah,
Bill said, and broke into a real grin for the first time that day. Ben grinned, Eddie grinned. Bill tossed the board aside, got up, and brushed off the seat of his jeans. He walked to the edge of the stream, and the other two boys joined him. Bill shoved his hands in his back pockets and sighed deeply. Eddie was sure Bill was going to say something serious. He looked from Eddie to Ben and then back to Eddie again, not smiling now. Eddie was suddenly afraid. But all Bill said then was,
You got your aspirator, Eddie?
Eddie slapped his pocket. I'm loaded for bear.
Say, how'd it work with the chocolate milk?
Ben asked. Eddie laughed. Worked great, he said. He and Ben broke up while Bill looked at them, smiling but puzzled. Eddie explained, and Bill nodded, grinning again.
Eddie's mom is worried that he's gonna break, and she won't be able to get a refund.
Eddie snorted and made as if to push him into the stream.
Watch it, fuckface, Bill said, sounding uncannily like Henry Bowers. I'll twist your head so far around you'll be able to watch when you wipe yourself.
Ben collapsed, shrieking with laughter. Bill glanced at him, still smiling, hands still in the back pockets of his jeans, smiling. Yeah, but a little distant again, a little vague. He looked at Eddie and then cocked his head toward Ben.
Kid's soft, he said.
Yeah, Eddie agreed, but he felt somehow that they were only going through the motions of having a good time. Something was on Bill's mind. He supposed Bill would spill it when he was ready. The question was, did Eddie want to hear what it was?
Kid's mentally retarded.
Retreaded, Ben said, still giggling.
You gonna show us how to build a dam, or are you gonna hit there on your big can all the day?
Ben got to his feet again. He looked first at the stream, flowing past them at moderate speed. The Kenduski was not terribly wide this far up in the barrens, but it had defeated them yesterday just the same. Neither Eddie nor Bill had been able to figure out how to get a foothold on the current. But Ben was smiling, the smile of one who contemplates doing something new, something that will be fun but not very hard. Eddie thought,
He knows how. I really think he does.
Okay, he said. You guys want to take your shoes off because you're going to get your little footsies wet. The mind mother in Eddie's head spoke up at once, her voice as stern and commanding as the voice of a traffic cop.
Don't you dare do it, Eddie. Don't you dare. Wet feet, that's one way, one of the thousands of ways that colds start, and colds lead to pneumonia, so don't you do it.
Bill and Ben were sitting on the bank, pulling off their sneakers and socks. Ben was fussily rolling up the legs of his jeans. Bill looked up at Eddie. His eyes were clear and warm, sympathetic. Eddie was suddenly sure Big Bill knew exactly what he had been thinking, and he was ashamed.
You coming?
Yeah, sure, Eddie said. He sat down on the bank and undressed his feet while his mother ranted inside his head, but her voice was growing steadily more distant and echoey. He was relieved to note, as if someone had stuck a heavy fishhook through the back of her blouse and was now reeling her away from him down a very long corridor. 3. It was one of those perfect summer days which, in a world where everything was on track and on the beam, you would never forget. A moderate breeze kept the worst of the mosquitoes and black flies away. The sky was a bright, crisp blue. Temperatures were in the low 70s. Birds sang and went about their birdie business in the bushes and second-growth trees. Eddie had to use his aspirator once, and then his chest lightened and his throat seemed to widen magically to the size of a freeway. He spent the rest of the morning with it stuffed forgotten into his back pocket. Ben Hanscom, who had seemed so timid and unsure the day before, became a confident general once he was fully involved in the actual construction of the dam. Every now and then he would climb the bank and stand there with his muddy hands on his hips, looking at the work in progress and muttering to himself. Sometimes he would run a hand through his hair, and by 11 o'clock it was standing up in crazy, comical spikes. Eddie felt uncertainty at first, then a sense of glee, and finally an entirely new feeling, one that was at the same time weird, terrifying, and exhilarating. It was a feeling so alien to his usual state of being that he was not able to put a name to it until that night, lying in bed and looking at the ceiling and replaying the day. Power. That was what that feeling had been. Power. It was going to work, by God, and it was going to work better than he and Bill, maybe even Ben himself, had dreamed it could. He could see Bill getting involved, too, only a little at first, still mulling over whatever it was he had on his mind, and then, bit by bit, committing himself fully. Once or twice he clapped Ben on one meaty shoulder and told him he was unbelievable. Ben flushed with pleasure each time. Ben got Eddie and Bill to set one of the boards across the stream and hold it as he used the sledgehammer to seat it in the stream bed. "There, it's in. But you'll have to hold it or the current'll just pull it loose," he told Eddie. So Eddie stood in the middle of the stream holding the board while water sluiced over its top and made his hands into wavering starfish shapes. Ben and Bill located a second board 2 feet downstream of the first. Ben used the sledge again to seat it, and Bill held it while Ben began to fill up the space between the two boards with sandy earth from the stream bank. At first it only washed away around the ends of the boards in gritty clouds, and Eddie didn't think it was going to work at all. But when Ben began adding rocks and muddy gook from the stream bed, the clouds of escaping silt began to diminish. In less than 20 minutes he had created a heaped brown canal of earth and stones between the two boards in the middle of the stream. To Eddie it looked like an optical illusion. If we had real cement instead of just mud and rocks, they'd have to move the whole city over to the old Cape side by the middle of next week, Ben said, slinging the shovel aside at last and sitting on the bank until he got his breath back. Bill and Eddie laughed, and Ben grinned at them. When he grinned, there was a ghost of the handsome man he would become in the lines of his face. Water had begun to pile up behind the upstream board now. Eddie asked what they were going to do about the water escaping around the sides.
Let it go. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't?
Nope.
Why not?
I can't explain exactly. You've got to let some out, though.
How do you know?
Ben shrugged.
I just do,
the shrug said, and Eddie was silenced. When he was rested, Ben got a third board, the thickest of the 4 or 5 he had carried laboriously across town to the Barrens, and placed it carefully against the downstream board, wedging one end firmly into the stream bed and socking the other against the board Bill had been holding, creating the strut he had put in his little drawing the day before.
Okay, he said, standing back. He grinned at them. You guys should be able to let go now.
The gook in between the two boards will take most of the water pressure. The strut will take the rest.
Won't the water wash it away? Eddie asked.
Nope. The water is just going to push it in deeper.
And if you're wrong, we could get to kill you, Bill said.
That's cool, Ben said amiably.
Bill and Eddie stepped back. The two boards that formed the basis of the dam creaked a little, tilted a little, and that was all.
Hot shit, Eddie screamed, excited. It's great, Bill said, grinning.
Yeah, Ben said.
Let's eat.
4.
They sat on the bank and ate, not talking much, watching the water stack up behind the dam and sluice around the ends of the boards. They had already done something to the geography of the stream banks, Eddie saw. The diverted current was cutting scalloped hollows into them. As he watched, the new course of the stream undercut the bank enough on the far side to cause a small avalanche. Upstream of the dam, the water formed a roughly circular pool, and at one place it had actually overflowed the bank. Bright reflecting rills ran off into the grass and the underbrush. Eddie slowly began to realize what Ben had known from the first. The dam was already built. The gaps between the boards and the banks were sluiceways. Ben had not been able to tell Eddie this because he did not know the word. Above the boards, the Kanduskeag had taken on a swelled look. The chuckling sound of shallow water babbling its way over stones and gravel was now gone. All the stones upstream of the dam were underwater. Every now and then, more sod and dirt, undercut by the widening stream, would fall into the water with a splash. Downstream of the dam, the water course was nearly empty. Thin trickles ran restlessly down its center, but that was about all. Stones which had been underwater for God knew how long were drying in the sun. Eddie looked at these drying stones with mild wonder, and that weird other feeling. They had done this. They. He saw a frog hopping along and thought maybe old Mr. Froggy was wondering just where the water had gone. Eddie laughed out loud. Ben was neatly stowing his empty wrappers in the lunch bag he had brought. Both Eddie and Bill had been amazed by the size of the repast Ben had laid out with businesslike efficiency. Two PB&J sandwiches, one bologna sandwich, a hard-cooked egg, complete with a pinch of salt twisted up in a small piece of waxed paper, two fig bars, three large chocolate chip cookies, and a ring-ding.
"What did your ma say when she saw how bad you got racked?" Eddie asked him.
"Hmm?" Ben looked up from the spreading pool of water behind the dam and belched gently against the back of his hand.
"Oh, well, I knew she'd be grocery shopping yesterday afternoon, so I was able to beat her home. I took a bath and washed my hair. Then I threw away the jeans and the sweatshirt I was wearing. I don't know if she'll notice they're gone or not. Probably not the sweatshirt. I got lots of sweatshirts. But I guess I ought to buy myself a new pair of jeans before she gets nosing through my drawers."
The thought of wasting his money on such a non-essential item cast momentary gloom across Ben's face.
"Well, what about the way you were bruised up?"
"I told her I was so excited to be out of school that I ran out the door and fell down the steps," Ben said, and looked both amazed and a little hurt when Eddie and Bill began laughing. Bill, who had been chowing up a piece of his mother's devil's food cake, blew out a brown jet of crumbs and then had a coughing fit. Eddie, still howling, clapped him on the back.
"Well, I almost did fall down the steps," Ben said. "Only it was because Victor Crisp pushed me, not because I was running."
"I'd be as hot as tamale in a head shirt like that," Bill said, finishing the last bite of his cake.
Ben hesitated. For a moment, it seemed he would say nothing.
"It's better when you're fat," he said finally. "Sweatshirts, I mean."
"Because of your gut?" Eddie asked.
Bill snorted.
"Because of your tit.
"Yeah, my tits. So what?"
"Yeah," Bill said mildly.
So what?"
There was a moment of awkward silence, and then Eddie said,
"Look how dark the water's getting when it goes around that side of the dam."
"Oh, cripes," Ben shot to his feet. "Current's pulling out the fill. Geez, I wish we had cement."
The damage was quickly repaired, but even Eddie could see what would happen without someone there to almost constantly shovel in fresh fill. Erosion would eventually cause the upstream board to collapse against the downstream board, and then everything would fall over.
"We can shore up the sides," Ben said. "That won't stop the erosion, but it'll slow it down."
"If we use sand and mud, won't it just go on washing away?" Eddie asked.
"We'll use chunks of sod."
Bill nodded, smiled, and made an O with the thumb and forefinger of his right hand.
"Let's dig a go. I'll dig 'em, and you should show me where to put 'em in, Big Ben."
From behind them, a stridently cheery voice called,
"My God! Someone put the Y pool down in the barrens, belly button lint and all."
Eddie turned, noticing the way Ben tightened up at the sound of a strange voice, the way his lips thinned. Standing above them and a ways upstream on the path Ben had crossed the day before were Richie Tozier and Stanley Uris.
Richie came bopping down to the stream, glanced at Ben with some interest, and then pinched Eddie's cheek.
Don't do that. I hate it when you do that, Richie.
Ah, you love it, Eds, Richie said and beamed at him. So what do you say? You having any good chucks or what?
5. The five of them knocked off around 4 o'clock. They sat much higher on the bank. The place where Bill, Ben, and Eddie had eaten lunch was now underwater, and stared down at their handiwork. Even Ben found it a little difficult to believe. He felt a sense of tired accomplishment, which was mixed with uneasy fright. He found himself thinking of Fantasia and how Mickey Mouse had known enough to get the broom started, but not enough to make them stop.
Fucking incredible, Richie Tozier said softly and pushed his glasses up on his nose.
Eddie glanced over at him, but Richie was not doing one of his numbers now. His face was thoughtful, almost solemn. On the far side of the stream, where the land first rose and then tilted shallowly downhill, they had created a new piece of bogland. Bracken and holly bushes stood in a foot of water. Even as they sat here, they could see the bog sending out fresh pseudopods, spreading steadily westward. Behind the dam, the Kanduskeag, shallow and harmless just this morning, had become a still swollen band of water. By 2 o'clock, the widening pool behind the dam had taken so much embankment that the spillways had grown almost to the size of rivers themselves. Everyone but Ben had gone on an emergency expedition to the dump in search of more materials. Ben stuck around, methodically sodding up leaks. The scavengers had returned not only with boards, but with 4 bald tires, the rusty door of a 1949 Hudson Hornet, and a big piece of corrugated steel siding. Under Ben's leadership, they had built 2 wings on the original dam, blocking off the water's escape around the sides again. And, with the wings raked back at an angle against the current, the dam worked even better than before.
Stop that sucker cold, Richie said. You're a genius, man.
Ben smiled.
It's not so much. I got some Winstons, Richie said. Who wants one?
He produced the crumpled red and white pack from his pants pocket and passed it around. Eddie, thinking of the hell a cigarette would raise with his asthma, refused. Stan also refused. Bill took one, and after a moment's thought, Ben took one too. Richie produced a book of matches with the words Roytan on the outside and lit first Ben's cigarette, then Bill's. He was about to light his own when Bill blew out the match.
Thanks a lot, Denbro, you wet, Richie said.
Bill smiled apologetically.
The three on a hatch, he said. But bad little luck.
Bad luck for your folks when you were born, Richie said, and lit his cigarette with another match. He lay down and crossed his arms beneath his head. The cigarette jutted upward between his teeth.
Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should.
He turned his head slightly and winked at Eddie.
Ain't that right, Eds?
Ben, Eddie saw, was looking at Richie with a mixture of awe and wariness. Eddie could understand that. He had known Richie Tozier for 4 years, and he still didn't really understand what Richie was about. He knew that Richie got A's and B's in his schoolwork, but he also knew that Richie regularly got C's and D's in deportment. His father really racked him about it, and his mother just about cried every time Richie brought home those poor conduct grades, and Richie would swear to do better, and maybe he even would, for a quarter or two. The trouble with Richie was that he couldn't keep still for more than a minute at a time, and he couldn't keep his mouth shut at all. Down here in the Barrens, that didn't get him in much trouble, but the Barrens weren't never-never land, and they couldn't be the wild boys for more than a few hours at a stretch. The idea of a wild boy with an aspirator in his back pocket made Eddie smile. The trouble with the Barrens was that you always had to leave. Out there in the wider world, Richie's bullshit was always getting him in trouble. With adults, which was bad, and with guys like Henry Bowers, which was even worse. His entrance earlier today was a perfect example. Ben Hanscom had no more than started to say hi when Richie had fallen on his knees at Ben's feet. He then began a series of gigantic salaams, his arms outstretched, his hands flopping against the muddy bank every time he bowed again. At the same time, he had begun to speak in one of his voices. Richie had about a dozen different voices. His ambition, he had told Eddie one rainy afternoon when they were in the little raftered room over the Casbrack garage reading Little Lulu comic books, was to become the world's greatest ventriloquist. He was going to be even greater than Edgar Bergen, he said, and he would be on the Ed Sullivan Show every week. Eddie admired this ambition, but foresaw problems with it. First of all, Richie's voices sounded pretty much like Richie Tozier. This was not to say Richie could not be very funny from time to time. He could be. When referring to verbal zingers and loud farts, Richie's terminology was the same. He called it getting off a good one. And he got off good ones of both types frequently, usually in inappropriate company, however. Second, when Richie did ventriloquism, his lips moved. Not just a little on the P and B sounds, but a lot. And on all the sounds. Third, when Richie said he was going to throw his voice, it usually didn't go very far. Most of his friends were too kind, or too bemused with Richie's sometimes enchanting, often exhausting charm, to mention these little failings to him. Salaaming frantically in front of the startled and embarrassed Van Hanscom, Richie was speaking in what he called his Nigger Jim voice.
Lawks a mussy! It's be Haystack Calhoun! Richie screamed. Don't fall on me, Mr. Haystack, sir! Use gwinter cream me if you do. Lawks a mussy, lawks a mussy. 300 pounds of swangin' meat, 88 inches from tit to tit. Haystack be smellin' just like a loader panther shit. I's gwinter lead yer inter de rang, Mr. Haystack, sir. I show enough gwinter lead yer. Just don't you be fallin' on dis yer black boy.
Don't worry, Bill said. It's just rubber Richie. He's kaka crazy. Richie bounced to his feet.
I heard that, Denbro. You better leave me alone, or I'll sick Haystack here on you.
The best part of you ran down your father's little leg, Bill said.
True, Richie said. But look how much good stuff was left.
How you doing, Haystack? Richie Tozier is my name. Doing voices is my game. He popped his hand out. Thoroughly confused, Ben reached for it. Richie pulled his hand back. Ben blinked. Relenting, Richie shook.
My name's Ben Hanscom, in case you're interested, Ben said.
Seen you around school, Richie said. He swept a hand at the spreading pool of water. This must have been your idea. These wet ends couldn't light a firecracker with a flamethrower.
Speak for yourself, Richie, Eddie said.
Oh, you mean it was your idea, Eds? Jesus, I'm sorry. He fell down in front of Eddie and began salaaming wildly again.
Get up, stop it. You're splattering mud on me, Eddie cried.
Richie jumped to his feet a second time and pinched Eddie's cheek.
Cute, 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 Richie exclaimed.
Stop it, I hate that.
Fess up, Eds, who built the dam?
Ben showed us, Bill said.
Good deal.
Richie turned and discovered Stanley Uris standing behind him, hands in his pockets, watching quietly as Richie put on his show.
This here's Stan the man Uris, Richie told Ben. Stan's a Jew. Also, he killed Christ. At least that's what Victor Chris told me one day. I've been after Stan ever since. I figure if he's that old, he ought to be able to buy us some beer, right, Stan?
I think that must have been my father, Stan said in a low, pleasant voice, and that broke them all up, Ben included.
Eddie laughed until he was wheezing and tears were running down his face.
A good one, Richie cried, striding around with his arms thrown up over his head like a football referee signaling that the extra point was good.
Stan the man gets off a good one. Great moments in history. Yowza, yowza, yowza.
Hi, Stan said to Ben, seeming to take no notice of Richie at all.
Hello, Ben replied.
We were in the same class in second grade. You were the kid who...
Never said anything, Stan finished, smiling a little.
Right.
Stan wouldn't say shit if he had a mouthful, Richie said, which he frequently does. Yowza, yowza, yow.
Shut up, Richie, Bill said.
Okay, but first I have to tell you one more thing. Much as I hate to, I think you're losing your dam. Valley's gonna flood, partners. Let's get the women and children out first.
And without bothering to roll up his pants, or even to remove his sneakers, Richie jumped into the water and began to slam sods into place on the near side wing of the dam where the persistent current was pulling fill out in muddy streamers again. A piece of Red Cross adhesive tape was wrapped around one of the bows of his glasses, and the loose end flapped against his cheekbone as he worked. Bill caught Eddie's eye, smiled a little, and shrugged.
It was just Richie. He could drive you bug shit, but it was still sort of nice to have him around.
They worked on the dam for the next hour or so. Richie took Ben's commands, which had become rather tentative again, with two more kids to general, with perfect willingness, and fulfilled them at a manic pace. When each mission was completed, he reported back to Ben for further orders, executing a backhand British salute and snapping the soggy heels of his sneakers together. Every now and then he would begin to harangue the others in one of his voices. The German commandant, Toodles the English butler, the Southern senator, who sounded quite a bit like Foghorn Leghorn, and who would, in the fullness of time, evolve into a character named Buford Kissdrivel, the movie-tone newsreel narrator. The work did not just go forward, it sprinted forward. And now, shortly before 5 o'clock, as they sat resting on the bank, it seemed that what Richie had said was true. They had stopped the sucker cold. The car door, the piece of corrugated steel, and the old tires had become the second stage of the dam, and it was backstopped by a huge sloping hill of earth and stones. Bill, Ben, and Richie smoked. Stan was lying on his back. A stranger might have thought he was just looking at the sky, but Eddie knew better. Stan was looking into the trees on the other side of the stream, keeping an eye out for a bird or two he could write up in his bird notebook that night. Eddie himself just sat cross-legged, feeling pleasantly tired and rather mellow. At that moment, the others seemed to him like the greatest bunch of guys to chum with a fellow could ever hope to have. They felt right together. They fitted neatly against each other's edges. He couldn't explain it to himself any better than that. And since it didn't really seem to need any explaining, he decided he ought to just let it be. He looked over at Ben, who was holding his half-smoked cigarette clumsily and spitting frequently, as if he didn't like the taste of it much. As Eddie watched, Ben stubbed it out and covered the long butt with dirt. Ben looked up, saw Eddie watching him, and looked away embarrassed. Eddie glanced at Bill and saw something on Bill's face that he didn't like. Bill was looking across the water and into the trees and bushes on the far side, his eyes gray and thoughtful. That brooding expression was back on his face. Eddie thought Bill looked almost haunted. As if reading his thought, Bill looked around at him. Eddie smiled, but Bill didn't smile back. He put his cigarette out and looked around at the others. Even Richie had withdrawn into the silence of his own thoughts, an event which occurred about as seldom as a lunar eclipse. Eddie knew that Bill rarely said anything important unless it was perfectly quiet, because it was so hard for him to speak. And he suddenly wished he had something to say, or that Richie would start in with one of his voices. He was suddenly sure Bill was going to open his mouth and say something terrible, something which would change everything. Eddie reached automatically for his aspirator, pulled it out of his back pocket, and held it in his hand. He did this without even thinking about it.
Can I tell you guys something? Bill asked.
They all looked at him.
Crack a joke, Richie, Eddie thought. Crack a joke. Say something really outrageous. Embarrass him. I don't care. Just shut him up. Whatever it is, I don't want to hear it. I don't want things to change. I don't want to be scared.
In his mind, a tenebrous, croaking voice whispered, I'll do it for a dime. Eddie shuddered and tried to unthink that voice, and the sudden image it called up in his mind. The house on Niebold Street, its front yard overgrown with weeds, gigantic sunflowers nodding in the untended garden off to one side.
Sure, Big Bill, Richie said. What's up?
Bill opened his mouth, more anxiety on Eddie's part, closed it, blessed relief for Eddie, and then opened it again, renewed anxiety.
If you guys little laugh, I'll never hang around with you again, Bill said. It's crazy, but I swear I'm not making it up. It really happened.
We won't laugh, Ben said. He looked around at the others. Will we? Stan shook his head. So did Richie. Eddie wanted to say,
Yes, we will too, Billy. We'll laugh our heads off and say you're really stupid. So why don't you shut up right now?
But of course he could not say any such thing. This was, after all, Big Bill. He shook his head miserably. No, he wouldn't laugh. He had never felt less like laughing in his life. They sat there above the dam Ben had showed them how to make, looking from Bill's face to the expanding pool and the likewise expanding bog beyond it, and then back to Bill's face again, listening silently as he told them about what had happened when he opened George's photograph album. How Georgie's school photograph had turned its head and winked at him. How the book had bled when he threw it across the room. It was a long, painful recital, and by the time he finished, Bill was red-faced and sweating. Eddie had never heard him stutter so badly. At last, though, the tale was told. Bill looked around at them, both defiant and afraid. Eddie saw an identical expression on the faces of Ben, Richie, and Stan. It was solemn, awed fear. It was not in the slightest tinctured by disbelief.
An urge came to him then, an urge to spring to his feet and shout, "What a crazy story! You don't believe that crazy story, do you? And even if you do, you don't believe we believe it, do you? School pictures can't wink, books can't bleed. You're out of your mind, Big Bill." But he couldn't very well do so, because that expression of solemn fear was also on his own face. He couldn't see it, but he could feel it.
"Come back here, kid,"
the hoarse voice whispered.
"I'll blow you for free. Come back here."
"No," Eddie moaned at it. "Please go away. I don't want to think about that."
"Come back here, kid."
And now Eddie saw something else. Not on Richie's face, at least he didn't think so, but on Stan's and Ben's for sure. He knew what that something else was. Knew because that expression was on his own face, too. Recognition.
"I'll blow you for free."
The house at 29 Niebolt Street was just outside the dairy train yards. It was old and boarded up, its porch gradually sinking back into the ground, its lawn an overgrown field. An old trike, rusting and overturned, hid in that long grass, one wheel sticking up at an angle. But on the left side of the porch there was a huge bald patch in the lawn, and you could see dirty cellar windows set into the house's crumbling brick foundation. It was in one of those windows that Eddie Kasprak first saw the face of the leper 6 weeks ago. 6. On Saturdays, when Eddie could find no one to play with, he often went down to the train yards. No real reason, he just liked to go out there. He would ride his bike out Wycham Street and then cut to the northwest along Route 2 where it crossed Wycham. The Niebolt Street Church School stood on the corner of Route 2 and Niebolt Street a mile or so farther on. It was a shabby, neat, wood-frame building with a large cross on top and the words, "Suffer the little children to come unto me," written over the front door in gilt letters 2 feet high. Sometimes, on Saturdays, Eddie heard music and singing coming from inside. It was gospel music, but whoever was playing the piano sounded more like Jerry Lee Lewis than a regular church piano player. The singing didn't sound very religious to Eddie either, although there was lots of stuff in it about beautiful Zion and being washed in the blood of the Lamb and what a friend we have in Jesus. The people singing seemed to be having much too good a time for it to really be sacred singing, in Eddie's opinion. But he liked the sound of it all the same, the way he liked to hear Jerry Lee hollering out, "Whole lot of shaking going on." Sometimes he would stop for a while across the street, leaning his bike against a tree and pretending to read on the grass, actually jiving along to the music. Other Saturdays, the church school would be shut up and silent, and he would ride out to the train yard without stopping, out to where Niebolt Street ended in a parking lot with weeds growing up through the cracks in the asphalt. There he would lean his bike against the wooden fence and watch the trains go by. There were a lot of them on Saturdays.